This week on Basic Black, when free speech slams into race and social media on the college campus, controversy erupts over racially charged tweets sent by incoming Boston University sociology professor Syeda Grundy. Also, in the midst of Deflategate, with domestic violence, child abuse, and drug abuse as part of the culture of professional football, we ask if the NFL really knows how to prioritize its penalties.
I find that this was a way for the NFL to cover up a lot of the other issues they're facing. We have child abusers, we have domestic violence going on, and they haven't addressed those issues well enough.
Also, we remember the legendary blues guitarist B.B. King, who passed away last night at the age of 89. That's our conversation coming up.
Our panel tonight, Philip Martin, senior reporter, WGBH News. Peniel Joseph, professor of history, Tufts University. LaToya Edwards, anchor, New England Cable News. Dwayne Thomas, chair and associate professor of sports management, LaSalle College. And Kim McLaren, associate professor of writing, literature, and publishing, Emerson College. To join the conversation, please visit our website at basicblack.org.
Penalty phase of convicted Boston Marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev is now over. The biggest news of the day locally. We now know that a jury has unanimously decided to give Jahar Tsarnaev the death penalty. And we bring in a man who has covered this trial from the very beginning. Philip, you've been there. You were inside. You are an insider. Give us the inside scoop. And what's your reflection on what happened today?
You know, I almost feel like the reflection has to start on the night that it happened, on the 19th of April 2013. And the reason is because I was there also in Watertown when the shots were ringing out at the boat, toward the boat, that Jahar Tsarnaev was hiding in. And bring us now to the present. Today, he, of course, was sentenced to die. He was convicted weeks ago of all 30 counts, and today he was sentenced on several of 17, most of the 17 counts.
Today was a big deal because so much speculation about whether, you know, all members of the jury would say yes to the death penalty.
Well, I'll tell you something. This was surprising. Some members of the press corps were not surprised, but very few. Mm-hmm. People in the court, some victims and survivors were surprised. No one was shocked because anything could happen in this trial. But surprised, I think, is the appropriate term. And what happened was that as we sat in the court, the jury forewoman, she basically said that the penalty is death, the death penalty. And you, courts are quiet anyway, but you could hear a pin drop in this one, if you don't mind me resorting to a cliche. It was extraordinary. And the reason I think that it was surprising were for two reasons. No one expected the decision to occur today, because you're going through 24 complex pages. And the second reason, of course, is because you figure the demographics of this community, that is to say Massachusetts, Boston, reflects basically militate against the death penalty, 2-1. People do not agree with the death penalty. But, of course, the jury supposedly is not influenced by public opinion. They don't read the tweets. They're not looking at Facebook. They're not looking at headlines. And what we saw today was a jury that felt that they came to the right decision. They were polled one by one about their decision in the court, and they basically agreed with the decision. So it was unanimous. But I saw no satisfaction on their faces. Mm-hmm. I didn't see jubilation on their faces. I didn't see triumphalism on their faces. What I saw on their faces was that they had done a job, it was over, and it was time to move on. And in fact, one juror I saw was almost in tears. Mm. And again, she had come to the decision that she made, but I don't think it was something that anyone was cheering in the streets about.
Philip, thank you so much. That was just such an inside look at all that had gone on, because, of course, no cameras inside the courtroom. So thank you so much. And now we're going to transition to another big story, really, in the entertainment world. I don't know anybody who does not like B.B. King. He passed away last night. Let's take a look at his life.
Legendary blues artist Riley B.B. King passed away last night at the age of 89. He sold millions of records and won 15 Grammy Awards. B.B., or Blues Boy King, was born in Mississippi and worked in the cotton fields before embarking on his musical career, which spanned over 50 years. He continued performing into his 80s with a rigorous touring schedule, including working with U2 and Eric Clapton. In 1987, King was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and his star was dedicated on the Hollywood Walk of Fame in 1990.
This is my girl, Lucille.
Rarely seen without his faithful Gibson guitar, King was not only recognized in the music field, but received the Kennedy Lifetime Achievement Award, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and just a few years ago, President Barack Obama hosted a concert celebrating blues music where B.B. performed. After all and until the end, B.B. King always let the good times roll.
You know, it just hurts my heart looking at that story. I don't know why. You know, we see stories like this all the time, but something about B.B. King, Kim, I saw it in your eyes as well.
Oh, he was, I mean, I never met him. I never had the honor of meeting him, but I think we all feel, you know, personally connected to him. Besides being the man who saved the blues, is what they call him, he seemed like just a genuinely good person. I claim him as a Memphis boy, even though he wasn't born in Memphis, but he got his start in Memphis, and that's where he first started becoming known to the black community. And, of course, he was very popular among the African-American community long before he broke out into white middle stream. But I think what's most important about B.B. King, or one of the things that's most important, is in fact that he cultivated and brought the blues to a new generation. Yeah. And the blues the blues are one of our greatest contributions to the world, right? The foundation of rock and roll and everything else. And B.B. King was the blues. So he was extraordinary.
And Peniel, you're a historian, a resident historian, so talk about the historical significance of B.B. King in black music, and music in general, really.
Yeah, I mean, B.B. King, born 1925, he's born in the Jim Crow South in terms of Mississippi plantation. Fannie Lou Hamer, born on a plantation in Mississippi as well. So there's an intersection between sort of rhythm and blues, but also the civil rights movement, especially its heroic period and after. From 54 to 65. And B.B. King certainly influences the Beatles. He influences a different generation. So he transcends the Jim Crow South, but he also, we talk about sort of jazz as global music. The blues is also global music as well.
Yeah.
And so when we think about hip hop, when we think about rock and roll, B.B. King is there.
You know, I got the news, you know, at NECN. I'd seen the tweet, and I go to work at 4 in the morning. And my co-anchor, who's this 40-something-year-old Jewish guy, he brought out his cell phone. He started playing B.B. King music. He was a B.B. King fan. My little girl, who's 8 years old, the way she connects with my mother-in-law is they dance to blues when she's over her house.
Nice.
So, you know, he spanned the generations. And it really, when I look at him, I see my relatives in him.
Right,
It's just heartbreaking on a real level. Philip, why are you laughing at me?
I'm laughing because I'm thinking about B.B. King playing as the backdrop to family reunions.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's what, you know, between Isley Brothers and other types of music, we would hear B.B. King in the background.
Right. Mm-hmm.
In many ways, that's symbolic, because you think about B.B. King, you even think about the blues period as sort of being the backdrop to our history, if you will, our theme songs.
Right.
And so you can go through the 60s and the 70s and through pivotal moments, and there's that B.B. King song playing in the background, whether it be in the background of Busing in Boston, or whether it be in the background of the blues crossing the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. It's this sort of theme song to sometimes not the happiest history, but a theme song nevertheless. And it informs our history, as Peniel said.
And it transcends. The great thing about the blues is that it transcends pain and suffering into art.
Yes. Precisely.
And that's what's powerful about it.
Yeah. Dr. Thomas.
More recently, it's been entertainment combined with athletics and sport, and the influence of music and the introductions ahead of the Super Bowl and major sporting events.
That's
true.
We
have the legacy of Lucille playing as part of the startup for the Super Bowl.
Yep. And
the influences that we have from the artists who've taken from the legacy of Mr. King to then be able to transition that into our entertainment world now.
You know, so that's a great point.
It's outstanding.
All right, so we have so much going on, and we're going to take a hard left right now. But another hot topic, and it's Syeda Grundy. Boy, oh boy, she sent out some tweets, and she's going to be, as of right now, a professor at Boston University. We see her right there. Does she have the right to tweet? And her tweets, are, depending on where you go, I know at my station we sort of handled it as they're racially charged. Some people called it racist, was talking about. And Peniel, you are jumping to say no.
Because I wrote about this for The Root this week as well. And I connected her and Michelle Obama. Michelle Obama gave this great speech at Tuskegee talking about what she's experienced as a black woman. It was a 27-minute speech, very nuanced, very eloquent. Conservatives pilloried her for saying, for playing the race card, right? Mm. What Saida Grundy did, she used Twitter as a blunt instrument. She was angry, at times very, very humorous, but she's talking about racism, she's talking about white privilege, but she admittedly didn't use it in a nuanced way. But in the context of Ferguson and Baltimore, what you have is this very sort of intelligent black woman, very well-educated, who is also angry. And so she was saying these provocative tweets. It's only 140 characters. But the only people who would think of those tweets as racist is an uninformed American public. Mm-hmm. When any time you talk about race, you're a racist. Now, the problem there is with the American public, and what we should be doing is educating them. So the problem there is not necessarily who's saying it. She said it in an impolitic way. She said it in a way that is just blunt and angry. And guess what? Black women have the right to be blunt and angry if they want to, but some of it was very humorous. When she said she tries to shop, she tries to not spend a dime at any white-owned business during MLK week, but she finds it impossible. It's hilarious. Yeah. That's the whole thing.
Well, some people are laughing at that.
Some people didn't find it funny.
But some of it was intentionally provocative, but she's intentionally
humorous. I don't know if it was intentionally provocative. I actually agree. Of course, she has the right to do it, and there's academic freedom, and there's no way, you know, some people were calling for her head and for her not to take the job and for BU to not hire her, which I think is ridiculous. I do think that some of the tweets were inappropriate. I mean, I think
as a professor,
I think that, you know, you have to walk a fine line. Frankly, this is one of the reasons I stay off Twitter, because Twitter is not a document, not a medium for expressing complicated thoughts. What she was trying to express was absolutely dead on. Right. But in 140 characters, it diminishes it. And I think there's a legitimate, you know, we all teach, you know, white students. It's a real balancing act, because you have to not only, it's not just what you said, but what they hear, right? And the tweet about the problematic students, you know, could be, I had some concerns with that.
Well, let me get to that tweet about the problematic students, just so people know what we're talking about. I mean, we've seen it, but, and this is, why is white America so reluctant to identify white college males as a problem population? You could see your white male students having a question about that.
Yeah, and she her context makes perfect sense. You know, white male students are overrepresented in certain problem areas on campus in terms of drinking and all these kind of things.
Sexual assault.
So that makes sense, but that's not what she said.
No.
And if you're a white male student sitting in her class, what you hear is, oh my God, she's gonna, you know, I don't think it's unfair to say, and she did apologize for the tone of her tweets.
Well, here's the
problem. She didn't have any choice.
Here's the problem. When you resort to, I would say, call these hasty generalizations. Yeah. It's not analysis. And the difference between hasty generalizations and analysis is the problem with that is the very point that you made. You cannot do that on Twitter. When you make these large-scale statements, white male students, white male this and that, of course, is going to be interpreted as
it's a broad
generalization. It is bereft of any analysis, and that analysis should occur, if she's going to make the analysis, it should have occurred in another forum, but not in Twitter. But I can understand the impulse to resort to Twitter. It's convenient. You are trying to express yourself, you're trying to get your expression to whatever number of followers you have, and you hope that they will get the meaning. The problem, of course, with Twitter, it is part of social media, which means it can be extracted and it can be magnified and it can appear on Fox News as something that it isn't.
I think the danger that we have is as both Kim and Philip have said, is that you can't complete your thought. You can't complete the whole context of what it is that you're thinking or even want to get across. But we have to remember that in this context, she's a sociology professor. Mm-hmm. And if we can't have sociology professors challenging and presenting issues that we should have discourse around, then who should present it? I mean, so you have to think about it from that context. She's coming to where society is afraid to challenge and talk about some of these issues that she just addressed and maybe misaddressed in the way, in the forum that she used, but not in what she addressed.
Well, but way she addressed it. Not in the forum and not what she addressed, because I agree with it, but it's in the way you address it. So there are three things, and I think that was the problem, was the way she addressed. To address the history of slavery and the impact of slavery, the continuing legacy, is a legitimate thing. To say white folks, slavery is a y'all thing, is not helpful.
Well, no, that's right, because it's not in their language.
No, but because it's not a y'all thing. Slavery is a universal thing.
No, it's universal. She was making an argument that we can get into. As somebody who I'm on Twitter more than anybody here, you get Twitter.
You how can't do you know
have,
that?
No, because I don't do it.
You can't make a very nuanced argument on Twitter because you can continue to tweet. Like some of us just live tweet different events. Black Lives Matter, Ferguson, Baltimore, so that's the thing. I think in this case, one of my biggest critique of all the conservative reaction and response is the fact that anybody who's talking about race in social media then becomes some kind of racist, right? So were her tweets imprecise? Absolutely. I'm not saying, were they tweets that I would have necessarily written? No, because I'm not her.
Right.
So, but can you do a nuanced analysis on Twitter? Absolutely. It's not just 140 characters. You keep tweeting.
I would put it this way. You can do a nuanced argument on Twitter, but some people can't. And the problem here was was the reductionism. We argue against reducing complex all the time. We argue on this show against reducing complex matters to stereotypes, to hasty generalizations. And the problem is that you have to be skilled in doing that. I'm not necessarily skilled in doing that. There's some things I'll stay away from if I'm trying to send out a tweet because I don't want to be misinterpreted.
And that's the whole key.
And that's
interpretation.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
Right.
So you know, let's look at this. Let's just quote at least one of them. Before Europeans invented it as such, slavery was not a condition that was de facto inherited from parent to child. You know, she's coming to a new campus at Boston University, and there are folks who are saying, okay, my child is signed up for your class. Now, if my child is not African American, are you speaking to him or her? And will my child do well in your class? Do you see that, Dr. Thomas?
Well, I see it in a number of ways. I see it as an African American who has to present to about 95% white students and having to push back any personal feelings that I might have about whatever the various issues are because I'm presenting to a majority audience. But then I have a responsibility to put the issues out there that in a way that says, how can I get my students to understand, although there's no other representation in the class, not be the black hero, but to be a voice that says, I need for you to be able to challenge the things that you think and that I think.
Right. But is it inflammatory, I guess, is my question.
I actually don't think that tweet is inflammatory because she's right. that tweet is right. I think the other one was problematic. But I agree with you very much, Dr. Thomas, that it is a balancing act. This is a real balancing act that black academics, let's be honest, have to judge who are teaching to predominantly, to students who are, you know, classrooms are predominantly white. And it's a challenge that I face every semester. The issue for me is that you do have to speak the truth. That is your first obligation. Your second obligation is to speak it in a way that it can be heard by the students, by all students, because that's your responsibility too. And sometimes that doesn't mean that you pull your punches, but that does mean you speak it in a way that they can be heard.
You know, I would push back a little bit on that. I've been teaching for 16, 17 years, and for me, it's never been challenging to speak to a predominantly white audience ever, because I've always talked about institutional racism. I've always talked about the deep misogyny, white supremacy of this country, and showed them in terms of empirically, what do we mean by that,
right?
So it's not challenging. But guess what? I've been misinterpreted, too.
So have I.
Because I say, look, you know, affirmative action, right? pro, I'm pro, you can have your anti, but here's why I'm pro, and here's what it really means, and here's how white people benefit from affirmative action, right? That can get you misinterpreted, too. So the idea that somehow, because we're black academics, that we have to speak in so-called objective terms or ways that somehow are going to ameliorate the pain and angst of our white students.
That's unfair. That's unfair, Peniel, because that's not what I'm saying, and that's what we get, listen, I consider it a good semester if I get accused by my white students of being a racist and my black students of Cowtown and the white students. I figure that that is not the case. But I do think you have a responsibility to speak about white racism, white, privilege, white stuff, and not y'all white people sitting in this classroom. That's different. That's right.
You can't have them point the finger and turn off to what it is, the message you're trying to get across.
Right. I also think these conversations always have to turn into how racism, if you will, hurts white people.
Yes.
Because, you talked about how affirmative action benefits white people. I also think one of the discussions that's missing in a broader discussion of racism in this country, whether it be in the form of tweets or Facebook or whatever form it is the larger issue of how racism hurts white people. White people militate quite often against their own interest. You think about Obamacare.
Yes.
Those who basically militate against or anti-Obamacare, but the minute the phrase is the Affordable Care Act, many people will in fact embrace it. We look at poll results that say this. No. And some have been explicit in saying, some polls have been explicit, not polls so much, I'm sorry, one-on-one interviews, where individuals have said it's because of Obama, who many people will disparage using code language as Barry or that Kenyan so it becomes important, but if that person did not have the Affordable Care Act, and let's just say we limited it to calling it Obamacare, and that person rejected Obamacare, and therefore this very poor person, in fact, and this has happened, we're seeing a lot of this in the South, in those states that have refused to accept Obamacare, where they've hurt themselves physically. They've hurt themselves, in terms of a real, real live pain by not accepting insurance simply because it's something that's probably
so the message is everything.
The message is everything.
Let me jump in real quick and let folks know that we have about 5 minutes left to the broadcast right now, and then we're going to take our conversation online. And in the midst of talking about Saida Gwandi and coming to Boston University, we're also going to add in another little angle here. We're talking about Deflategate. We've all heard that term very much over the last month or maybe half a year, right, as far as the season is concerned with the NFL, five months. So here's a little taste of what we're going to talk about.
If you're not playing the game the way that people expectations of the game, why would you need to take air out of a ball? To most young people, that's, I think, logic would tell them that it's cheating.
It's a very disappointing situation, very disappointing. And I was born and raised here, so I'm really disappointed in the Patriots.
There's a lot of players in the NFL that have been failed role models for kids much before Tom Brady, but it is just really unfortunate and really illustrates the difficulty when confessing when you're caught at something, that if you try to deny it and cover it up, it just gets worse.
Everybody is laughing on this panel right now. I'm not going to laugh. I'm a huge New England Patriots fan, so we're going to have a good conversation online. Yeah. But let's finish up Saida Gwandi right now. Dr. Thomas,
yes.
I will put it out there like this, and I'm so happy that I'm surrounded by professors, because after I read her tweets, and she has very provocative tweets, we can all see them, and folks at home can Google them and see them for yourself. If it was, and people at home will be saying this, some people are watching this, if this was a white professor who started tweeting about, let's reverse the language and say, y'all black African, people, whatever, and reverse the conversation, would that person be called a racist? Would that person, you think, be told that their invitation to teach would be rescinded at Boston University?
Well, but that's not a fair comparison.
Why?
Because the history of black people and white people is not the same
it's
in this country.
It's not the same.
It's unequal
power.
It's unequal power.
It's not the same because it's just like why we have Black History Month, right? Mm-hmm. And people say, well, why not White History Month?
Well,
because you believe that white history is all year long.
It's different. You get it all year round, and by the time you're saying you want White History Month in a white supremacist society, you're doing something much different than Black History Month, which is set up as a challenge to the status quo.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but I feel like we are covering stories right now because of Baltimore and Ferguson that point out more than ever, I think the media is finally jumping on the bandwagon. We're always late to the game, but we're talking about racially sensitive or racially controversial topics. There's a principal in a southern state who said, was quoted, yes. She said, she ended a graduation early. The valedictorian didn't get a chance to speak, so she got up on the microphone and said, hey, don't leave, even though it was her fault for ending it. You really need to hear this message. Look who's leaving. Look at all the black folks leaving. And she got into so much trouble and was called,
fired.
And was called a racist for that. And she said, well, I didn't use the N-word. Why am I a racist? So I'm saying that why is she criticized? And I'm just saying there are people watching, and this woman who's called.
I have to agree with my colleagues because of historical context.
Yeah. Yeah.
But everybody doesn't look at it that way.
Historical context really matters. Again, I don't agree at all with the way that she went about promulgating her message and trying to teach a lesson. I think it's wrong. But the juxtaposition of white racism, black racism. You can talk about racism. A lot of people can be racist. Black people can be racist. I'm not of the opinion that black people can't be racist. They can be. Yeah.
And you believe?
To continue the conversation, see past episodes, or discover new stories, please visit our website at basicblack.org.
The type of call someone might make if this was a white person.
So what does she have to do to be racist? Because she's obviously saying on MLK Day, I try not to shop at. She calls them out white businesses.
But that's talking about self-determination.
She's talking about
self-determination and criticizing institutions.
Or some people say we're just putting a nice spin on the fact that she's calling. Self-determination. That's a great way to say.
The whole thing, the interesting part about being black in this country is this, and that's what she shows, especially when you're a black academic. Intellectuals, that you're critiquing the system that produces Baltimore, right? That produces Ferguson. Mm-hmm. There's no white equivalent of that. You see what I'm saying? So even as white people might be offended as you're critiquing that system, there's no white equivalent of that same offense. There's not a bunch of white ghettos in this country and white people being incarcerated at mass rates and being shot by the police and they're